Today we're going to speak with Frank Quillacy. Frank is the only person to ever play for the Twins, coach the Twins, manage the Twins, and serve as a Twins announcer. Frank played for the Twins in 1965 and again between 1967 through 1970. Frank went into coaching in 1971 and was named the Twins manager in 1972 and served in that capacity through the 1975 season. Frank, I understand that you were born and grew up in Chicago. What was it like growing up in Chicago? Did you grow up playing a lot of sports? And what was your favorite sport?
Well, I guess my favorite sport was softball. We played with what we called Windy City Ball in the Chicagoland area, and it was 10 guys and a 16-inch softball with an 11. It was actually an 11 foot arc. No gloves. The ball was just about as hard as a baseball. But that's how I got my start with my dad. My dad loved softball. Started his team at General Motors Parts Division, and he used to take me with him all the time. And so I didn't start playing baseball until a park supervisor by the name of Pete Klein, who became a really dear close friend, got me involved in what back then was the Liberty League. It was a 12-year-old, 13-year-old league, and so we began to play baseball, and I think really the fundamentals of playing with a softball with no glove and it being as big as it was, we really had to learn how to throw it properly and catch it properly, and it really helped me to become a good defensive ball player in baseball.
Did you play different positions, or how did that work?
Well, I actually did. I played a lot of shortstop. I played some second base, and I loved to catch.
Really?
And I think catching, I wasn't a big kid. By the time I was 14 years old, I was only 98 pounds and 4'11".
Mm-hmm.
And that was my first year of high school, and in the ninth grade. And so, but I loved putting the stuff on and being behind the plate, and you know, you get into the game, and it really helped me a lot as far as learning about a lot of things, and actually watching a lot of pitches. So I went from that into played just about every age group, and that's what was wonderful about Chicago. We had a terrific park system, and you could get a bunch of guys from your neighborhood and in an age group go into the park, and I think it probably cost us $1 a piece, you know, to register our team.
Mm-hmm.
And you would get two balls and two bats for a game.
Wow.
From the park. If you broke the bats, you had to bring the handle back. And if you tore the skin off the ball, you had to bring the skin back. And what happened in these leagues, John, was at the end of the year, they picked an all-star team in the age group from that park. And that all-star team would represent the park in a city championship round. And you had a south side and a north side that would play for the city championship in Wrigley Field.
Boy, that must have been fun.
It was. I was there a couple times, and if people have ever played in Wrigley Field at the time, it was an umbrella infield for the as far as the water was concerned for drainage. And when I got into my position at shortstop, to get in a get-ready position, and I leaned down a little bit, all I could see was the first baseman's head. So I had a cheat and come in on the infield.
Wow.
But we won the city championship a couple times at that age level, and we went on and played in Altoona, Pennsylvania, in a 15-, 16-year-old league later. It was called the Connie Mack League. And we graduated from 12 and 13 to 14 and 15. And we were playing with two age groups, so I think you got a lot of experience. you know, at an early age, playing with a kid at that age, you know, there's quite a difference as far as growth and experience. And I think it got me ready for playing the senior league, which was 17 to 18. We actually won about four, I'm not sure, I can't remember anymore, four or five city titles. And just had some great ball players in that neighborhood. And Pete Klein over at Harrison Park was probably the most influential on my life. He had played Triple-A ball with the New York Yankees, and unfortunately they had Lazzari and Crosetti and I'm trying to think who else up in front of him, so he never got out of Triple-A ball.
Well, back then, you know, there were so few teams.
Yeah, and they could. We didn't know the contracts. We'll probably discuss that later. But they could hang on to a guy his entire productive years and keep him down in the minor leagues, and he'd never go anywhere. And we had a lot of wonderful players in our neighborhood, and a couple of the guys, a fellow by the name of. It was Frankie Strzecek, that's who it was, Frankie Strzecek, and another kid, Bobby Zintek, and they both signed contracts and D-ball, and they went for about 3 weeks, and they were getting paid so little. They came back, and I said, "How come you guys came back?" And they said, "Heck, we can make more money betting on ourselves on the weekend." And so a lot of my buddies that I played ball with ended up cops, firemen, machinists, sheet metal guys, a lot of the trades. We had big schools for you know, all different types of the trade.
Mm-hmm.
And so a lot of our guys went into it. My cousin was a prime example. And I was going to go to college, but that's a story for a little bit later.
I'm sure a lot of them just went into the trade just because the money was so much better.
Well, it was, and if you didn't have a trade, you had a very menial job, you know, and it was, you know, working in the grocery stores and, you know, doing things like that as far as service industry, and there really wasn't a lot of money around, but we had four foundries in my neighborhood. And they made a lot of brass parts, chrome-plated and nickel-plated stuff, and it was hardware and different things for different industries. And about four blocks away was the McCormick International Harvester Works, and my uncle was an inspector there on the tractors.
Mm-hmm.
And then to the south or north of us was the Burlington Railroad Yards. So we were kind of captive from the north and south, and on the east, that was getting close, pretty close to Halsted, which was close to downtown, and then on the west, it was not too far going to Cicero. So it was, and there were a lot of kids there. I had the good fortune of moving five blocks from my Italian neighborhood to a Polish neighborhood. My mother was Polish.
Mm-hmm.
Took me about 3 weeks to convince those guys that my mother's name was Domanowski. And, because we battled, but my cousin, Ronnie Polka was his name, was a member of Union League Boys Club. And my aunt said, "Why don't you go see Ronnie at the club? It cost $7, $1 to join the club. And we had everything there. And in my neighborhood, we had Union League Boys Club that was sponsored, and they sponsored two clubs in Chicago. They were the Union League Foundation of downtown Chicago. They were all the top executives in the city of Chicago and surrounding area. And it was a men's club, and so they supported these two nonprofit organizations. And in the same neighborhood, we had Gads Hill Social Center, which was a place that taught us parliamentary procedure. And it was the third house that was a social center in the country. The first two were Hull House and Marillac House, and they were also in Chicago. So we had a lot of fun there. We learned a lot about organizing our club, and enjoyed it a lot. They had a lot of social things for boys and girls. And back then, the boys' clubs didn't let girls in.
Yeah.
And so it was strictly boys. They figured they get the boys off the street, they'll reduce crime.
Probably true.
Yeah. So anyway, that was pretty much of my upbringing, and as far as until it actually was a great one because there was a fellow by the name of Bill Handel who taught me how to play basketball. And I was a good basketball at that level player. And so I played at Harrison Park, at McKinley Park, at Douglas Park, Gads Hill, and at the Boys Club. And I was going to go to a Catholic high school from my grade school when I graduated the eighth grade. And Bill Handel convinced my dad that I should go to St. Mel High School, which was taught by the Christian Brothers.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't want to go because it was an all-boys school. And my cousin and my buddies were going to St. Anne's right in the neighborhood. But he convinced my folks, and Brother Basil, who was the president of the school, he said, "I'll make a deal with you, Frank." He says, "You stay here 3 weeks and give us a chance." And he said, "If you don't like it," he says, "I'll pay your way back to the neighborhood and buy you lunch, and I'll get you involved in St. Anne's." Once he had me for 3 weeks, it was over.
Is that right?
Yeah. We didn't have baseball in high school.
Okay.
Because it was a non-revenue sport, and there were a number of Catholic schools in difficult neighborhoods. More or less, you know, we didn't know we were poor, John. Everybody was the same.
Yeah. Yep.
And so as a result, we didn't have baseball. Yep. And so all of my baseball was in the park system. And fortunate for me, it was a great system in Chicago that gave us a chance to play.
Well, it sounds like it. And, you know, the kids today just don't have those kind of things available to them, or choose not to participate because they're too busy with their computers. And
you know what, John? And my son is going through this with his 9-year-old right now. And unfortunately, it costs a small fortune for them to play any type of competitive baseball, even at that age. And they don't have leagues where the kids can just sign up, you know, with a bunch of their buddies like we did. And so it's costing him an arm and a leg, you know, just to have his son play and his 6-year-old daughter take place in gymnastics. And it's just a shame because I think it discourages a lot of families and a lot of kids,
yeah,
you know, to go into some of those sports.
Yeah, and like you say, some families certainly can't afford that kind of money.
No, and my son can't either, and I try to help him that way as well as he's creative. And he quit a job in the car business that was going nowhere and became a handyman. And how he ever became a handyman, I don't know, because the only time I ever heard my father swear was when he tried to fix the plumbing, and I followed in his footsteps.
Interesting. Yeah. Did you, when you were growing up, did you follow the professional baseball teams?
You know, we did. My father was a diehard White Sox fan. We weren't that far from Sox Park. We were in what was called the Heart of Chicago community. It was the geographic center of the city, which is on the near south side. And then across the Chicago River was Bridgeport. That's where all the mayors used to live. And, of course, our current mayor went to De La Salle, and so did his dad. And De La Salle was a Christian Brothers school about 5 blocks away from Comiskey Park.
Hmm.
So the only time I ever got a chance to go to the ballpark was doubleheaders on Sundays. And my dad, some great ball players there at the time, and of course they didn't win a pennant while 1969, they finally won the American League pennant. But they had a lot of great players. That's when Chico Carrasquel was at short, and Nellie Fox was over at second. Dave Philly, Ed Sherm Lawler. They got Ted Luzuski from the Cincinnati Reds, and Jimmy Rivera, Jim Busby. Manny Minoso was outstanding. They were good players, and they were fun to watch. My dad could only afford the tickets out in left field, and we were lucky sometimes to get the first seats right over the 375 mark in left center. And we'd only go to doubleheaders because you get two for the price of one, practically.
Sure.
So at the end of the first game, I used to ask my dad, can I get an ice cream bar? And he'd look at me serious, and he said, you come here to eat or watch a ball game? He says, besides that, we'll get one when we leave here. And he says, they're cheaper out there. And he says, I can have one, too.
Well, that sounds pretty good, though. But that had to be fun. My first baseball game happened to be the 1965 All-Star game.
Oh, for crying out loud. That was a great one.
Yeah, and, it turns out, it's kind of ironic, but my parents are both Polish.
Oh, okay.
But I was born in Germany, and then we moved here, when I was five.
What's the full name? Swolinski?
No, Swole, as far as I know, is
really?
Is the full name. Yeah.
You better check it. There's got to be a scam.
You're probably right about that. But after high school, you went to, what was it, Loras College?
Loras College.
And then on to Western Michigan University. How did that all come to pass?
Well, I was president of the Young Christian Students of Chicago. And I went to a national conference in Rensselaer, Indiana. I met a kid by the name of Dorrance Bakey out of Dubuque, Iowa. And we started a friendship, and at that, and I told him I wanted to go to college, and he said, well, why don't you, you're a good ball player, why don't you see if you can walk on the baseball team? And he says, my dad can get you a job, and you can live with us in Dubuque. So I went, and I worked, on weekends I worked on a rendering truck.
Ooh.
And picking up dead animals. And during the week after classes, this was the fall, so it wasn't baseball at that time. And I was a emergency orderly in surgery at Xavier Hospital. So I was working about 60 hours a week and taking the full 15 hours.
Wow.
And not making much money. And eventually what happened, I went the one semester, and I was in the second semester, and I just really couldn't do it financially and couldn't wait for baseball season to show I could play. And so I thanked the family. Dorrance's folks were wonderful people. And I hitched a ride home back to Chicago, and I went to work in the brewery and in the bottle shop.
Well, you had some interesting jobs.
Well, at the time, the brewery in the bottle shop, those were all union shops, and it was the highest paid unskilled labor in the country. And in 1956-57, and I had that summer job all the time I was in college, and it was over about $3.10 an hour. And I got overtime. And luckily I had a Italian straw boss, and a lot of the Italians ran the bottle shops. And Al Raffalo was his name. And he found out I wanted to play baseball, and he says, go see Danny Ryan up in the crow's nest, and that's where you used to dump the cans onto a scrambler, and it went down into the filler to get filled, and then into the pasteurizer, and then on to receiving. And so I worked the morning shifts from 6:15 to 2 o'clock, and I was able to play baseball because of him.
Well, that's pretty nice.
Yeah.
Pretty nice.
Yeah, good guy. In fact, my uncle, International Harvest Day used to go on strike like 40 to 100 days out of the year. They were striking every year. He had seniority as an inspector, but he's laid off. I got him a job at the brewery. And he said, Frankie, he says, you saved our family by getting me the job. He says, unfortunately, I got to go back because I've got seniority. But every time he went on strike, my buddy hired him.
Hey, that's great. That's a great story. What about Western Michigan University?
Well, that all came about because my dad was the only time he came to see me was on Saturdays or Sundays, and he never came around the bench. He always stayed out in the field because he was a hothead. And if something happened to me, I think he's liable to go fight somebody. But he's a wonderful man, my dad. And he got to know, for some reason, a scout came up to him and said, I understand your son wants to play ball. And he said, yeah, he does. And he says, but he can't get it. You know, I don't have the money to send him to college. And so the guy's name was George Moriarty. And George played in the same outfield with Ty Cobb. And later on became an umpire in the National League. And he became a scout in his later age. And so he approached me and my dad one day after the first game of a doubleheader at McKinley Park. And he said, Frank, I think I can get you into Western Michigan. I said, Western Michigan, where's that? He said, in Kalamazoo, Michigan. I said, well, where's that? You grew up in the city of Chicago. You didn't know geography. And he says, it's over on the other side of the lake in Kalamazoo, Michigan. He says, they got good baseball there, and they got a great coach. He says, I can't get you a scholarship. He says, but I think I can talk the coach into letting you walk on. And so I had my uncle, who was the inspector. My dad didn't didn't have a good car at the time. In fact, I bought a car for $125 when I was 16 years old, and I taught my father how to drive. And so my Uncle Wally took me there. And we drove in, and I called the coach up, and I said, I understand I got a scholarship. He says, no, we don't have a scholarship for you. I said, what are you talking about? I said, he told me I was going to get a scholarship, which I was lying.
Uh-huh.
But anyway, he says, come into the office and let me talk to you. And he says, I can get you some jobs here. He says, we can get you through school. He said, he says, you'll do all right. So I went in and he got me a job. I played my freshman year, and actually my road roommate freshman year was Jim Bouton.
Really?
Yeah, I wrote ball for and was on the New York Yankees. And Jimmy and we had a good freshman year. And Jimmy came up to me. He said, Frank, he says, I'm sorry, I can't go with you, you know, next year. He says, I signed a contract with the New York Yankees. They're sending me to San Antonio. So Jimmy went, and so I was a walk-on on the varsity in my sophomore year, and fortunate for me, unfortunate for the starting shortstop. Back then, if a scout was going to look at a guy, he had to talk to the college coach.
Okay.
And because he interceded, and they used to help the coaches out, too, by scouting for him for some guys like me to bring him on there and say, yeah, hey, this kid can probably help your system. So anyway, the shortstop was a fellow by the name of Craig Morris, and unfortunately he talked to a scout without talking to Charlie, and Charlie put me in the lineup and he never played another game.
Wow.
And so that's how I got to Western, and in Western Michigan I went all 4 years, and we went to Omaha twice.
And you were an All-American there.
Yeah, I was a a walk-on. In my sophomore year, I didn't have a very good year offensively, but we had a good team. We ended up going to the College World Series in Omaha, and I think we finished third, or I don't know. It didn't matter to me. We didn't win. We didn't finish first. What did I care?
Yeah.
But then my junior year, we would have had even a better team because it was loaded with seniors. And there were good ball players, and we just didn't do it. We didn't make it, but I made second team All-American and had contracts offered to me. And the Yankees, Pat Patterson came to me, offered me a major league contract. And back then, the general consensus was that you needed to play between 500 and 600 professional games before of different elevations in the minor leagues for you to know everything you were going to know to play in the big leagues.
Holy cow.
And if you did well in D-ball, you went to C, you went to B, or maybe you bypassed it. Then you go to A, double A, triple A, and then to the big leagues. And so that's what happened with me. And I went to Erie and got off to a bad start. They waited for the rookie league in Whitfield, Virginia, and that's where I met Tony Oliva. And Tony had been released, and Minnie Mendoza out of Charlotte, North Carolina, convinced Phil Hauser to keep him around, and so he signed him to a contract and sent him to the rookie league, and he led all of professional baseball, hitting .411 that year.
You signed with the Yankees, or you signed with the Twins?
I turned down the Yankee offer. It was $28,000 in a major league contract.
And you turned that down?
Well, I had always promised my dad and myself that I would finish college. And I just told Pat Patterson, I said, you know what, as good as that seems, I said, that's four times more than what my dad makes in a year.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, because I think my dad was making about $7,000. And I says, but I know if I don't finish, I said, and I get a taste of baseball, I'll never go back. And so that's really what happened, because my ex-wife was pregnant with our first daughter.
Mm-hmm.
And so I stayed. And we didn't know back then the difference between a major league contract and a minor league contract. And so my senior year, I had a good year, and we went to Omaha. And I made first team All-American. And I did not get an offer from the Yankees because they were only signing younger guys, and I was 21.
Okay.
And so Dick Wincek, who had been in Kalamazoo, saw me play, and he says, Frank, he says, here's my deal. And this was at Omaha, and I guess he was breaking a rule, but we were standing in a telephone booth, and he says, I'll give you a Charlotte contract. He says, I'll give you a progressive $15,000 bonus. And he said, I will give you a $600 a month salary at Charlotte, North Carolina, at double A ball.
Okay.
Says, oh, that sounds good. First of all, the $600, I'm thinking it's for the whole year.
Uh-huh.
It was just during the season. And our meal money was $2 a day.
Wow.
And you only got paid during the season, and that normally was like in a full year. I went there in June, so I only got paid June, July, and August. And so I had to go to winter ball to make some money, and that was only about $450 a month for 2 months. And trying to get a job in the off season was really tough. But I was lucky, being from Chicago, the guys over at the brewery helped me out and got me a job in the wintertime.
And pretty much back then, that was pretty much true for everybody, wasn't it? That the players had jobs during the offseason.
Sure, players. There was no way that the minimal salary when we got in there was $5,000, and $5,000 a year. You stayed over 30 days, you got it up to $6,000. And you know, ball club's got 25 guys. There's nine regulars and four regular starting pitchers and maybe a relief pitcher that got paid. The rest of you were scrambling. And it took Carmen, I think, almost 13 years to make $100,000. And when he made the 100, he was about the 10th guy in baseball to make that much money.
Yeah, I can remember when I was growing up when they announced that Harmon signed for $100,000. That was a big deal.
Yeah, and but Kelvin used to sign Harmon first, and then he didn't have to pay anybody else because he said, "Well, I can't give you more money than Harmon."
That's amazing.
Yeah.
Well, you spent a number of years in the minor leagues. I think you spent parts of about seven seasons there, and you played over 700 games in the minor leagues.
Yeah, well, I played the full season at the rookie league, and then I jumped. I went to Charlotte, and for the first month, and you know, in the big leagues back then, they would take 28 guys north. And it was a trickle-down effect. At the end of a month, three guys got cut off the big league club. And they went down to AAA, and then it was, you know, revolving door all the way down to D-ball.
Sure.
So I went to the Sally League. First guy I faced in Chattanooga was Ferguson Jenkins.
Wow.
And I said, if they're all like this, I'm getting myself a teaching job. But anyway, we faced him, and that first month they sent me back. And that was to Wilson. And in 1962, and then in 63, the same thing happened. I didn't have a real good year in 62, but I played every day, and the manager liked me, and we had a nice little ball club. And so in 63, I was at Charlotte again, and they figured I ought to spend a full season at Wilson, North Carolina, to prove I can play at that level. So I made the All-Star team that year. In 64, I went to Charlotte, and I made the All-Star team in that league. And the next year, I went to Denver. I made the All-Star team in that league. And the word was out on me that I couldn't play every day in the big leagues.
At that point already, huh?
Yeah, yeah. That was small. I played about 156 pounds.
Mm-hmm.
And really only until 68 when I played third base that I gained weight. Because second base, I was backing up first all the time, jumping around and going all over the place. And, of course, 65 in Denver, I was having a great year. Our team was having a great year. We had a lot of good players on that AAA team. And, of course, Bernie Allen got hurt, and so did Jerry Kendall. And they tried Rollins over there, and his position wasn't second. He was more of a third baseman. And I was having a good year, and so they brought me up in July.
What were the circumstances of how you were told that the Twins had called you up?
Cal Ermer is a wonderful human being and a great, great baseball guy. He lived for baseball, and he was just a good man. And we had a great relationship, and we were in a battle with Indianapolis, who was a White Sox franchise, and Oklahoma City, who was a Houston franchise. Back then it was the Colts, or 45s. And anyway, they were a half a game behind us, Indianapolis. And there was a quirk in the schedule. We had to play 10 straight games. in the Houston ball club in Oklahoma City, they were a game and a half behind us. We went and played, I think it was 4 over there and 6 over at our place. It was 6 at our place first and then 4 there because we were coming back. We had to go to Oklahoma City. We beat them 10 straight. Wow. There were 10 and a half games out. But when we got finished with them, we really had a good time. So we were celebrating like heck going into Oklahoma City. And all of us were feeling pretty tired the next day. And the manager, the trainer called us, Buck Chamberlain. He called me and Dwight Siebler. He called me up and he said, "Irmer wants to see you." I said, "Oh, Christ." I'm in for it. I said, because we had a good time. I was rooming with Ron Henry. He's a black catcher out of Philadelphia. And he was a good singer. And so I actually helped him to start singing in some clubs.
Really?
Yeah. He was scared of the microphone. I said, "Well, I'm not. I can do Amen." Anyway, Ronnie and I really had a good time. We had a good nucleus of guys. We would go out together. You only had 19 guys on a team, and I'll bet you 17 guys went out all the time together.
Wow.
So I said to Chamberlain, I said, "Oh, geez, what the heck did I do now?" So I go and I see Irmer, and I says, "Oh, well, what I do now, Cal?" He says, "You did enough to go to the big leagues. You're going this afternoon." I said, "Oh, geez."
Well, that just got to be really quite the moment.
Well, it was unbelievable. And just, you know, you battled through those years in the minor leagues. And I actually was going to give myself 5 years. And if I didn't do it, I was going to either teach or I was going to get into sales. And that was my background in college. And so it was 4.5 years, actually, jumping all over the place. We said that my daughter Kelly, who was the oldest, she was a baby. She graduated. She was born. The guys were waiting for me in the bus downstairs when I was in the recovery room with my ex, and they told me that everything was great. Go on to Michigan and beat those guys. And we did.
Holy cow.
And so I just said, this rat race. Kelly, we figured, lived in 76 different houses and apartments by the time we got to the big leagues.
That's amazing.
Yeah. With winter ball, trying to get a job, going to see, and spending time in Chicago, spending time in Michigan, and the different odd jobs that you get, seasonal jobs and stuff like that, and then going to spring training, going to your first club, getting sent back to another club.
Sure.
That's 76 houses and apartments.
You made your major league debut on, I have here, July 18th, 1965, in the first game of a doubleheader. I think the Twins lost that game to the Angels.
Yep.
You came in, I think, later in the game and ended up following out to Vic Power at first base off of Bob Lee that first at bat.
Yeah, I said, at least I didn't strike out.
That's right. But you started the second game.
Yeah. Yeah, Sam Neely came to me when I got to the ballpark. It took me and Dwight Siebler over 13 hours to get to the ballpark with connections back then. And we pulled into the Maryland Hotel, and it was $6 a night. We didn't know where we were going to sleep, where we were going to eat, what we were going to do. But they said that Oliva was going to take us to the ballpark in the morning. And I said, "Oliva? He's driving a car?" And Tony and I had, he went in front of me as far as the minor leagues were concerned. And anyway, he says, he couldn't even ride a bike when we were with Bill. So anyway, Tony said, "Oh," he always called me Franklin. "Franklin, oh, it's going
Tony was must have been quite the character.
Tony still is. He's one of the most genuine, wonderful human beings you've ever met in your life. And he's taken up golf now, and I'm trying to give him, even though, you know, it's better to be a teacher than a performer. And I'm giving him a few tips when we get a chance to play, and he's a quick study, believe me.
Really? I just don't picture Tony as a golfer.
You know what? He almost hits it the same way he hits a baseball. He takes the ball back and stops at the top of his, when he's taking his backswing, and then look out. And he gets the heck out of it. And it's the short, you know, golf is getting there, and the short game, and he's learning the short game.
And
he's a pretty darn good putter.
I'll be darned. I talked to him just a couple times. I have trouble following his, you know, understanding him sometimes. Mm-hmm. But he seems to be a really fun person.
Well, you know what, John? The one thing about Tony is he's genuine. And when you get to know him a little bit, and it's something that he gets excited or he starts talking, what I always did with Tony, because I said, Tony, I didn't understand what you were saying. Can you tell me, you know, tell it to me again? And he's always been gracious, you know, too, and never took offense to the fact that I didn't understand him or anything. And he's just real people. What you see is what you get. And his wife is just as neat. Cortez is a wonderful girl. They've been married over 40 years.
Yeah, he's, I see him, you know, down in the spring training when we spend a couple months down there in Florida, and so I hang out at the ballpark quite a bit, and you see him just always talking to the young guys and showing them and talking to them, and he seems to really enjoy that.
Well, I hope they're listening to him, because he forgot more about hitting than they'll ever know.
It's probably true.
No, it is true.
Probably true. So what do you remember about your first day in the big leagues? What kind of special memories does that hold for you?
Well, the mere fact that, you know, I got a couple hits in that game. I actually think I stole a base for one of my five. But, you know, I had always had my thoughts that I could play shortstop in the big leagues. And the grind of a major league, you know, season then, I saw Zoilo taking some ground balls. And the next day we're going, and I says, I'm glad there was a spot at second base for me. And so what I really remember, after the first game, Zoilo was happy we won. And I said, you know, Zoilo, I've been playing every day and every minute, and so have you. And I says, would you do me a favor tomorrow, if we feel good, would you come out and take ground balls with me? And he says, why? And I said, well, everybody's ball is a little bit different on how it hits your glove. And I says, I would like to get the feel of how the ball's coming out of your hand. He said, we'll see how we feel after the doubleheader. And so he was really happy after the game, and he came to me and he says, I'll see you at 2:00. I talked to Billy Martin. And he said, he'll hit ground balls to us. I says, that's great. So we went out the next day. I didn't get much sleep anyway. Again, after that first day, I was so excited. But we must have taken, 100 ground balls. He backhanded them. He quick fed me and quick wrist and that kind of stuff out of his glove. And finally, we were both sweating pretty good. And he says, where do you like it? And I says, you've got to field it and throw it. I said, you get it somewhere around second base. And I said, I'll take care of the rest. Never got a bad throw thrown, Jeff.
You say, all right.
Never got a bad throw. He played such great shortstop that year, and it's no wonder they gave him the most valuable player.
Now, what I remember about him was a couple things. One, you know, when he played, he made some amazing plays, and then sometimes, you know, on the simple ground ball right to him, he would boot it.
Well, you know what? It's a perception because you didn't get a chance to see him every day.
Yeah, I agree.
And playing with him every day, not that year. It might have been a little bit before, but not that year.
Is that right?
No, sir.
The other thing I remember about Zoilo was after he had left the game, you know, he wasn't doing that well.
Right.
And I remember being out at Met Stadium, and it was after a game, and he was sitting out in the parking lot talking, and you know, his English wasn't that great, but he was talking to a number of kids,
uh-huh.
And he was telling them about baseball and whatnot, and he had his glove, and he had a ball, and he was kind of just throwing the ball up in the air and catching it and talking to these kids,
uh-huh.
And the conversation, I listened for about 15 or 20 minutes, and then he looked like he had some place to go, so he was starting to wrap it up, and this one little kid that was listening said, boy, you know, Zoilo, he said, you know, I really like your glove. And Zoilo said, you like my glove, huh? It's probably pretty big for you, but he took his glove off and he gave it to the little kid and he walked away. You know, and that just stuck with me all these years.
You know, and, you know, he was that way too. He was really misunderstood by a lot of people, Janet. Zoilo was, you know, the only reason that some of the things happened, that no one thought that he had a bad back. And he ended up having surgery on that back, and I really think it was the painkillers that actually took his life.
Hmm.
And because when he left us, he was you know, went to the Dodgers.
Yeah.
He was in pain, and they thought he was jaking it. There were a lot of people thought he was jaking it, but and he was misunderstood a lot of times too. Because at first, you know, he was pretty moody at first because he had left Cuba, and
yeah,
you know, and Josefa wasn't there with him. He was a young guy. And so he was, he just didn't know, and you know, he didn't know people either. He didn't know Americans either, and you know, and so there was always a lot of doubt casted over him, but you know, and I really had a special bond with him, and I loved him, and we were together 3 weeks before he passed away, and the same thing was going on. We were at the Twins. One of the rare times I was involved with a Twins autograph deal at one of the stores, and we took the kids out, and we were showing them the double play and everything else. He was having the greatest time of his life.
Hmm.
And we gave each other a big hug and said goodbye to him, and that's the last time I saw him. But, boy, I'll tell you, that year, he was so good, and I just really felt for him because he just, you know, he wasn't an educated kid, and so baseball was his life. And when he couldn't play baseball anymore, that really, really hurt him.
I bet it did.
And it just it made you sad. So it was unfortunate because he had a wonderful family. He had five daughters, and those painkillers were hurting him.
Hmm.
And it was even hurting his relationship with a wonderful wife, too. And so I just hated to see that happen.
Yeah. For some reason, I seem to think that Alexei Casilla resembles Zoilo. I don't know why. I've looked at some pictures, and to some degree they do. But for some reason, to me, there, you know, there's just a resemblance there.
Well, there's, I think some of the mannerisms... Casilla probably could be as good a defensive player as Zoilo was. I don't think he'll ever have the power that he had.
Right.
Zoilo, I don't know if he was 150 pounds. He had 20-something home runs one year. And he could run like a deer. I think he had 40-plus doubles in that year, and almost half of them were balls that were hit between third base and shortstop. The left fielder looked up, and he was about two strikes away from second.
Yep, he was an amazing player.
He could fly.
No question. 65 was obviously a magical year for you and the Twins, and you guys went on to play the Dodgers in the series, and you appeared in all seven games. And in the first game, you faced a Hall of Famer in Don Drysdale, and you tied a World Series record by getting two hits in one inning.
Uh-huh.
What was that like?
Well, afterwards, it was wonderful. When it was happening, I came back to the bench after the second base hit. Joe Nosek was sitting there, and he said, "What are you trying to do, set a record?" And I said, "What are you talking about?" He said, "We just got your second hit." I'll tell you the truth, I actually thought it was two innings. Like I said, I was in a daze anyway. I came out on the bench before the ball game. There was a guy sitting there, and I said, "How you doing?" He says, "I'm doing fine." He was in a suit and tie, and I said, he introduced himself, and I said, "I'm Frank Quilisi, I'm a rookie. I came up to kind of watch them hit batting practice and stuff." I said, "What are you doing on the bench?" He says, "Oh, I'm waiting for some of the front runners to go." And I says, "Really? Who's that?" He says, "Well, all the guys." I said, "Well, what's your name?" He said, "Gene McCarthy." He was a center.
Wow.
Yeah, he was a good guy. And I didn't know his politics at the time, but he's a good man.
What about... Tell us what it was like to face Sandy Koufax, and do you think that Koufax was the greatest pitcher you ever saw?
Well, facing Koufax was really the best word, surprise, because he was so smooth as far as his delivery that you didn't know the ball was doing what it was doing. His fastball, he could get his fastball to do four or five different things. He'd sail it in, he'd sink it in, he'd sail it away, sail it down and away. And I think the double I hit off him in the seventh game, I think I started to swing just as the ball was coming out of his hand. And it hit my bat because it was straight as a string, because it didn't get a chance at belt high to move.
Mm-hmm.
But he definitely was capable of pitching a no-hitter every time he pitched. And the only guy that I would put up with him, pretty close to his standards that lasted a long time, was Nolan Ryan.
Yeah, that would be quite the pair.
Because they both had outstanding fastballs. Ryan grunted every time he threw it. But Koufax, he just threw it, and he was just smooth as silk. But they both had a great curve, similar to Camilo Pascual's. It was what we call a 12 to 6 o'clock. But they both had change-ups. And they had those three pitches in... They were around that strike zone, and so Koufax, he was amazing, and I don't know what my record is against him, but I got a little cocky. I told somebody I think it's 2-5.
Well, you get a single hit off of Koufax, I think you did pretty good.
Yeah, well, I had a couple. I don't know how many times it's bad, though.
I was in a Navy boot camp at Great Lakes in 65, so yeah. I missed that entire World Series. What do you think was this kind of, or was there a single turning point in the series that kind of turned it toward the Dodgers, or was it just the fact that Koufax pitched in that seventh game?
Well, it was two things. Jan Kipper didn't last long enough, and Claude Osteen shut us out in the third game, and that gave Koufax a chance to pitch his third game.
Mm-hmm.
And you aren't going to beat Koufax too many times. And he shut us out in the second game. And I believe he did. But we didn't get too many runs off him anyway. We didn't,
yeah.
We didn't play our game in L.A., but it was a whole different ballpark, and they didn't have a powerful team home run wise, but they're running to death. And great pitching. Johnny Roseboro was a catcher on that ball club. He was a heck of a player, and he came over to us later on and showed it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but Koufax pitching three times. I think he's probably going to beat you 2 out of 3.
Certainly, I would agree with that.
Uh-huh.
What can you share with us? What kind of money you received as a losing share of the World Series?
Well, fortunately, the team voted me a full share, and a full share back then was $6,600, and the Dodgers got $8,800.
Wow!
And I understand now that it's somewhere in the $300,000 for winning.
You get a full share of the world's World Series money. Did you get a World Series ring too?
Yeah, I did, and the rings were pretty chintzy back then, from the standpoint of handing them out. The only guys that got them were the 25 players on the roster, and the coaches and the manager, and I think the trainer might have got one. But they probably gave one to Doc Lynch. But other than that, Calvin might have bought some for his brothers. But I know that some of the minor league coaches and some of those guys got a ring, but it wasn't the ring that we received. They didn't have diamonds, so.
Hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
Yeah.
So you spent the following season, you spent the entire season with Denver. And how difficult was it to go back to AAA after having played in a World Series?
Well, I'll tell you the truth. I really thought that I was going to get an opportunity to play to earn the second base job. But I was pretty naive. And because when they signed you to a major league contract, they had 6 options that they could option you back to the minor leagues.
6 then, huh?
6. But if you remember, Charlie Finley was one of the few guys that caught on to a little-known fact, and that is you can bring a kid up for 29 days, send them down, and you didn't use up an option.
They had it all covered then.
Yeah. And so I was on the bus, and I was going to Houston for spring training, the last week of spring training. We were going to open up on the West Coast. And Sam Mealy got off the bus and called me. He says, Frankie, he says, unfortunately, I don't make all the decisions. He says, but I got to send you back to Denver. And I looked at him, and I just, you know, it just hit me like a ton of bricks. And I just said, you know what, Sam? I said, you have to do what you have to do. And I says, I know there's, you know, other factors in it. I says, but let me tell you something. You better find somebody that Zoilo likes to play next to him. And I says, because it's important that somebody knows how to treat him during the season. And I says, and become his friend. And just then, Zoilo came off the bus. He says, he used to call me Dago. Dago, what's going on? I said, Zoilo, listen to me. I said, Sam's got to send me back to the minor leagues. And I says, I want you to keep playing, man. I said, you're the best shortstop in baseball. I said, somehow I'll get back here. I says, but you got to keep on playing. I said, you had the greatest year last year. And I said, next year, I said, you'll be one of the best paid players in major leagues. He said, I have you back in 6 weeks. Only they didn't bring me back. They brought Tovar back.
Mm-hmm.
And I was there the whole year. But when I came back, Neely said, put your glove in the locker. You're on vacation. Next year, you're going north. And he kept his promise.
Yeah.